Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined, as ever, by my colleagues Jane Mayer and Susan Glasser. Good morning to you both.
Hey, Evan.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
President Biden and Donald Trump clinched their party's nominations last week, which solidifies the rematch that we've all come to expect. But today we wanted to step back and try to get some perspective about not only this election, but politics more broadly. The three of us are reading a lot these days, and we thought we'd highlight some of the books that are helping us make sense of it all. Susan, what has caught your attention lately? What have you been reading that you think people should know about?
Well, we can certainly talk about what we're reading to escape from this endless election. It's going to be the longest general election, I think I read somewhere, since Al Gore and George W. Bush locked up their respective party nominations in early March of 2000. So lucky us, right? And actually, I do like to read a lot of fiction just to escape from things. But to your point about how does the past sort of shape our thinking about the future today? One of the best of the recent books that I have read and done a couple book appearances for, because I think it's really a terrific piece of history that's relevant to the moment, is a book by Jacob Halbrin called America Last, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. You know, some of you might be familiar with the Rachel Maddow book that came out last year, which I also read and thought was excellent, which was called Prequel, and it was about a particular episode in World War II that illuminated kind of the American right's outright flirtation with fascism in some cases. But America,
what was it actually about? I've heard just little bits about the Maddow book, but I don't actually know what it's about.
Yeah, no, it was about the Hitlerites inside of America and the journalists and investigators and other people who worked to bring them to account, including it culminates in this big trial, actually, of American Nazis that takes so long that it basically kind of fizzles out at the end of World War II when, you know, kind of the moment has passed. But what I like about Jacob Halbrin's book is that it takes the story back farther in time. It has a much longer arc of the history of the American rights fascination, taking it all the way back to Kaiser Wilhelm and the events leading up to the First World War. I had really never thought about the fact that H.L. Mencken, who was probably the most prominent writer, columnist of his time, essentially was a far-right arch-conservative apologist, not only for the Kaiser, but later on for the right-wing movements in Europe. And this story, it establishes a through line that makes you feel that Trump is much less of an outlier. Like, where did this fascination with dictators and strongmen, where did it come from? It's not just some fever dream of, you know, Donald Trump's quirky personality. And, it's a terrific book. By the way, it's not very long. He wrote it in a very short period of time. I highly recommend it, actually.
The ideal, the book that not too long. That you know, I mean, I had heard that in the Maddow book that that Henry Ford plays a big part too. Correct? I mean, it's a sort of a major industrial figure, obviously in American history, but also whose anti-Semitism was very inspiring to Hitler himself.
Well, that's right. What was inspiring to Hitler was Henry Ford's industrialization and the model of the Ford cars. Hitler was a huge fan, actually, of America and, you know, saw the United States and its powerhouse economy as a model for Germany. But sadly, people like Ford took Hitler as a model in a very terrible way. He is a character in that Maddow book. What I loved about Jacob's book was that it shows that this strain in the Republican Party never fully disappeared. And it, of course, makes its appearance in McCarthyism. It makes its appearance in why is the right obsessed with who lost China in the aftermath of World War II. I mean, Evan, you're such a student of America and China. What I found particularly interesting about Jacob's book was this finally helping me to understand this debate today.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of the China of the mind. I mean, there is a way in which it serves this symbolic function over the decades, and we sort of rediscover it every few decades. And, you know, as I hear Susan talking about it, I think, you know, it's not just this question of what could happen here, but we have at our moments in our history, it has happened here, that we have had these sort of the fascist impulse asserts itself. Jane, what are you thinking about as you're reading?
Well, actually, I mean, and I'm always going back and trying to take a look at American history. And it's much in the way Susan's talking about. These threads, and you might even call them these viruses, kind of live on almost from the start of the country. And they bloom at various points along the way, and sometimes in very toxic ways. You have the toxic blooms. I'm looking at a book just now that is called The Longest Con. It hasn't come out yet. It will soon. It's called How Grifters, Swindlers, and Frauds Hijacked American Conservatism. It's by Joe Connison, who's a sort of a leftist writer. He's written a lot for The Nation in the past. And it has a foreword of all people by George Conway from, Republican and anti-Trump conservative. And basically, again, like what Susan's looking at, what's interesting to me, it goes back to the 50s. It starts actually with Joe McCarthy. And what it takes a look at is, you know, if you're trying to understand, you know, how did conservatism get to be what it is now, what we're looking at, which is Trumpism is not even conservative. I mean, it's not small government. It's, you know, big spending on various things and strongman politics. How did this happen? It's been a lucrative grift to basically con Americans who have grievances. It's not just an ideology that puts people in power, which it has done, but it's also a business, a booming business. And so basically this book is really, it's actually fun. It's written really well. It relives some of the great con men in modern American politics. Mm. And the bottom line was good.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money to be made in all this. The final chapter is called The King Con, and that's about Trump.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm intrigued by this the history of money as an object of politics, sort of in addition to the ideological stream. Just the fact is that this has been a lucrative enterprise for people. I happened to read a really interesting book the other day that's not out yet called Offshore by a sociologist named Brooke Harrington, who decided, I want to understand the hidden world of finance, you know, how money moves around the world, how you end up with Londonistan and all these places where power and money kind of intersect for global oligarchs. And so she said, I'm going to train as a private wealth manager. And she went and got certified. And so then she could go out, and she was upfront about it. She says, I'm a sociologist. But as a result, she was sort of inside the tent and was able to go around the world to all of these little tiny islands that have these tax regimes where people are able to stash their fortunes. And she's been able to write about it from the inside rather than kind of trying to make sense of it just through documents. And some of these extraordinary interviews get to something that I think is lurking in the history of what Jane was just describing, which is that over time, these systems that began as kind of informal ways of making money and hiding money have been perfected and optimized and refined and ultimately mass-produced on a scale that there really is a separate world for saving your money and not consenting to the world of taxation if you know where to look and how to do it. And she has written a book that does this better than anything I've seen.
You know, what's wonderful about that book, it sounds like, is that it's a way of thinking about economic inequality, which is a hard subject to write about in this country, but is actually a very important factor in our politics, and the resentment that it has bred on the bottom and in the middle as so much wealth has moved to the top.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We've got a bunch more books we want to talk about, and we'll come back in just a second.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, Susan, you've got another book on your brain that is related to some of the things we've been talking about.
You know, the subject of Vladimir Putin is one that I've followed for a long time. And if you look at the role that Russia is now playing, not just within its borders, but as a kind of geopolitical actor, you know, they are at the table in American politics this year in a way I can hardly remember. And somebody recommended this to me. I just, you know, devoured this in a couple of days. It's actually a novel. And it's called The Wizard of the Kremlin. And it is sort of a fictionalized account of Vladimir Putin and a character called Vadim Baranov. But really what it is Vladislav Surkov, who was kind of the Machiavellian chief ideologist of Putinism in the early years up until recently for Vladimir Putin. This book is written by someone who understands power firsthand. The author is an Italian writer, Giuliano D'Ampoli. He served as a chief political counselor and advisor to one of Italy's recent prime ministers and is really a student, I think, of power politics much more than he is. He's not like a career Kremlinologist or anything, but it is just a masterful effort to try to get us inside the mind and thinking that led to Putinism.
I think it's interesting, this idea of using fiction to tell truth better than nonfiction in a way about politics. I mean, as a nonfiction writer, of course, like feel a little challenged by this. But but you know, there's the book The Netanyahus too, which is a novel about about the Netanyahu family. I mean, I suppose there's a way that by using your imagination, you can get in behind closed doors that as a reporter are closed to you. Does it discomfort you, though, to see this combination of fiction and fact?
Well, look, it's very explicitly a work of fiction. And, you know, we don't have access to Putin in an enough of an unfiltered way to really understand the machinations of the Kremlin. And so to me, it gets at mindset. You know, it's not the literal truth. We don't center enough. We don't have enough information. Among the Russia hands, there is definitely a view right now that we have less understanding and insight into the day-to-day workings of the Kremlin than we did even in the late Soviet period, that we are just starved for real insight and information. And I will say there's another book that I'm reading right now that is the nonfiction version of this, and it certainly would be infinitely preferable. But Steve Call, our colleague and a great Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, has just come out with this book, The Achilles Trap, Saddam Hussein, the CIA, and the Origins of America's Invasion of Iraq. I've just started the book, but the amazing thing that is relevant to this question of fiction versus nonfiction is that Steve teamed up with terrific journalism lawyers, First Amendment lawyers, and they sued the government to obtain this amazing archive, you know, quotes from him and facts and recordings. And, you know, that, of course, is what we don't have from Vladimir Putin. And, of course, Saddam has now left the world, left the stage. Putin is very much still a malevolent actor shaping our events. You know, I would be amazing to have, and I hope that history ultimately will somehow find a way to give us, you know, the insights into what's happening in Putin's Kremlin.
But and I gather that Saddam, meanwhile, when you finally get all of these records, he's sitting in his bunker writing
novels.
Fiction,
yeah,
a novel.
Exactly.
You know, I just do want to give one plug to exactly who those lawyers were. They were for the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press, and it's a fantastic group. I used to be on its board, and you know, more power to them.
Here,
wonderful.
Here.
Absolutely.
Well, and one of the things that I think Steve Call has done, which is the hard, in some ways it's almost the rarest and hardest thing, is to get inside the mind of the dictator. You know, they make it so hard to do. And that is the real prize. You know, in some ways there's like this kind of, if you write a lot of books in your life, you start by, you know, looking at it from a distance, trying to describe the many players. And in the end, I think what we all ultimately aspire to is to try to get as much as you can into the brain brainstem of that most mysterious and oftentimes destructive figure. And I think it's just incredibly tempting. In the China context, I will say we're living through a time now that is really difficult because Xi Jinping is an especially impenetrable target because he knew for a long time that he wanted to be the top guy, and as a result was almost making sure that he laid down as few markers as possible. He wrote, quote unquote, wrote a column for a while in a local newspaper, which you can mine to see what at least some of his advisors thought because they were presumably the ones writing it. But it's really challenging. And one of the books that I've read recently that I thought did help me get into the substructure of the Chinese system is a book called The Sentinel State by an American scholar named Min-Chin Pei, which is fascinating because what he does is he punctures this illusion that it's all, that the whole story of authoritarianism right now is about tech, high-tech stuff. Actually, what he notes, and I think this applies probably in the Russian context a bit too, is really, it is about low-tech surveillance, that it is still, in the end, the base structure is the person who lives on the corner, who sits in a lawn chair and watches the comings and goings and sees who is standing with whom, what books are arriving at their front door, what magazines are they reading. And I sort of love that fact as a reminder that oftentimes, signals intelligence gets you only so far. Really, it's putting eyes on the target.
I have to say, having written way back about the Stasi in East Germany, there is nothing creepier than the guy in the lawn chair.
Yes,
who is
well
your
said.
Neighbor who is taking notes. And that sounds like a fantastic book.
Jane, you've been thinking a lot about U.S. politics, about the courts especially. What have you been reading that's caught your attention?
Well, I was going to say, as the flip side of The Longest Con, which is about the operatives in American politics who rip off the voters, the other side of that that's interesting in this puzzle that I think many of us have, which is, why is Trump's base so devoted to him? And so for that, I was reading White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, which is by Tom Shaler and Paul Waldman. This, of the books I've read, it's one that's out relatively recently. And it's quite a controversial book. It's been attacked by the right to some extent, and by some of the scholars whose work is in it, who say it was taken out of context, because it's a pretty unvarnished attack on something that's really a sacred cow in American politics, which is sort of rural Americans who sort of you think of as being, think of them as more American than anyone else. The farmers,
the American Gothic,
American Gothic, the small town. And what it's saying is that these people are angry and they are resistant to change and that they are anti-intellectual, anti-science, pro-authoritarian, reactionary, and full of hate. And one of the things that the book says, and one of the points it makes that I think is very valuable, is that they have disproportionate power. Some of the small rural states have the same power in the Senate as the highly populated states. They have disproportionate power in the Electoral College. And for these reasons, their views, even if they're out of step with the majority, have great sway and something worth knowing. I mean, I would argue that it's a mistake to call all rural right Americans reactionaries and say that they're all Trumpies. But for the most part, this has a lot of very interesting information about the sort of mindset and the conditions that created the Trump base. The kind of livelihoods that gave them respect in the past are gone.
Yeah.
And they're furious.
And I think that there is a ramifying effect over time that people who are now making the choice to live in a rural area or an urban area are making a choice that ends up encompassing a whole range of their experiences. It's not just where you are, and it's really who you run into, who you're likely to marry, where you're likely to go to school, what you're going to read online. It becomes a defining factor. I was talking to a strategist the other day who says that in his mind, it's not education that is the central dividing line in politics. It's density. Do you live in an area where there are more than 800 people within 1 square mile? That really has all of these predictive powers when it comes to trying to understand political behavior.
Well, and Evan, your great book, of course, you go back and do reporting in West Virginia, where you spent time right after you graduated from college, as a young journalist. I mean, is this about a shift? I mean, some of the stuff that Jane's talking about is kind of familiar over a several decade-long process, and it doesn't naturally, in my view, lead to Trump. So I'm just curious, having spent time on the ground, do you think there was a moment in time, or is it more of an evolutionary process?
I think it is an evolutionary process, but there are these step changes. I mean, Trump is the one that we all noticed in the biggest way. That's where it kind of seemed to crystallize people's unannounced preferences, that suddenly, okay, Trump was speaking in a language that others had not. But, I'll give you another example of a book that for me has been very clarifying on this, which is this book called Filter World by Kyle Chayka, one of our colleagues at The New Yorker. What he does that is really eye-opening, and you don't use that expression with sincerity about a book very often, is that he explains how we live in this algorithmic age, meaning that the algorithms are not just telling you that, after you search for a lamp, that all the ads you're going to see for the next week is lamps. It's also shaping even things as subtle as the little tile on Netflix that identifies what the film is about. So your tile, Susan, might look different than the tile that I'm shown for the same show.
That's amazing.
Exactly. Based on what they think will make you respond. And it's operating all the time, just below the surface of our lives. And I think, that's a way in which these, we might put ourselves into a situation where we think, okay, I can get around the fact that my local paper in this rural area is going to give me one set of ideas. But it's extremely hard to get around it when you are swaddled in this algorithm to a degree that you don't even fully appreciate day to day.
I'm finding some of the algorithms that think they know me quite insulting recently.
What are they offering
I'm seeing wrinkle creams and I don't know. It's just like they're rushing it, okay? I'm just going to say that.
Agreed. What we really need is the book that's going to teach us how to beat the algorithm.
Yeah, wow.
I mean,
okay.
One thing.
Kyle, if you're listening, yeah, there's part two.
Part two.
I mean, there is, I have to say, because of the reporting I do on Twitter, I follow vast numbers of people that I might not want to sit down to have dinner with. So my choices must be very confusing to the algorithm because they cross the political spectrum. And maybe that's how you beat the algorithm, is don't be predictable.
Well, that's right. Look, in the old days, in the age of direct marketing by mail, there was a kind of prehistoric version of this, right? Like I remember when we all got everything in print, we would have all the newspapers, but also we would get the conservative publications like the Weekly Standard or whatever. And definitely the marketers were confused by that.
They
totally did not understand who we were, but they've refined it, I think, even more to an art. And that Netflix example is really scary. I want to now like go and when I go to your house, I'm going to look on your Netflix and see if it's different than ours.
All right. We're going to come back in just a second. We're going to take a quick break and we've got some more books to come.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large. today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All right, Susan, we've been engaged in some escapism for a moment, thinking about non-political topics, but there is a stack of important political books that have been circulating recently. What has really caught your attention?
Well, look, in our household, there's no question we are, you know, trying to stay on top of all of the new piles and piles of Washington books. But the books I really want to shout out, because they're actually good books, are two politics books that have been written by a couple of our colleagues at The Atlantic in recent years. And again, I've read a whole swath of the politics books, but the very best ones, in my view, of the recent ones are McKay Coppin's book, which is just sort of not quite authorized, but as told to by political biography, Romney, A Reckoning, it's called. And he had really unique access to Mitt Romney and shows, I think, the transformation of the Republican Party from Romney's point of view, going from the nominee of the GOP to essentially a man without a party and anathema in the Republican Party in just the space of a few years. And I really, it's an excellent portrait. It's not really a full biography, but it's also a very good read. And the same thing goes for a different and kind of more ambitious historical book, Tim Alberta's The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, which looks at the kind of chokehold of Christian evangelicals, white Christian evangelicals, over the Republican Party. And again, there's a through line here of people who have personal connection to these stories. McKay Coppins, like Romney, comes from a Mormon background. He was able to share that frame of reference with Romney. And in a similar way, Tim Alberta came from a family. His own father was this very conservative Christian evangelical minister. That's the church that Tim grew up in. He shows how even at his own father's funeral, his parishioners were turning
scene.
On Alberta for his journalism. And his wife says to him at the wake for his father, says, you know, after hearing these parishioners deal with a grieving family by talking about Trump and talking about politics, she finally says, what the hell is wrong with these people? Mm. And that, in a way, is the inspiration for Tim to go on this journalistic journey of discovery to try to understand the dysfunction inside the church that has powered so much of our politics in recent years. It's an excellent book of both journalism and thinking.
I think it's a great idea for anyone interested in politics to try to better understand evangelical Christianity and their role in politics this year, because it seems to be growing. And I was just going to say, there are a number of good books that I've read in that area, too, that I would recommend. Anything by Sarah Posner, who wrote a book, Unholy, and Catherine Stewart's written a number of books. And there's a good documentary out that she made with Rob Reiner, that's also on this subject. And there's a book called Playing God that's by someone named McConaughey. It is interesting. It's on the Catholic right. So not just evangelicals, but also on the Catholic right. So anyway, but I think it's a really rich area for people covering politics and trying to understand it.
And the other thing that I think they do, and that Tim Alberta's book does, is that it helps us understand the difference between a movement and conventional politics, because that is a substantive difference that I didn't fully grasp. The whole Trump phenomenon, it was like, oh, is it about this guy or is it about something? And actually, a movement is a really specific form of political force. And we're still getting our arms around. Because look, Joe Biden is not a political movement. He's something else. And you have to sort of understand and be able to differentiate them. Jane, I was thinking, you know, you're looking pretty hard at the court these days. Is there anything that you've read that you think begins to get you inside the court?
Well, there is actually a book that is going to come out soon. And it's a book by former Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. And it's surprisingly readable, considering that it's a book about how to interpret the Constitution. It's called Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. And what it does is it just basically, I would say, it blows the whistle on the dominant form of interpreting the Constitution on the court right now, which is originalism and textualism. It basically says this ideology that's dominating the way the Supreme Court is interpreting the Constitution these days is kind of nonsense. All law is really interpreted by people, and you always have to take into account its effect when you make a decision. And that's basically what he's arguing for, and it's very, very interesting. It goes through the Dobbs case and many other cases. He doesn't go after his colleagues. He's not that kind of person. But he really, I think, takes apart their ideology in terms of their interpreted methods. And I think it raises a lot of questions about, you know, whether the what the Supreme Court's doing is really neutral, or is this just another sort of form of politics?
You know, Jane, the Supreme Court has always been the hardest of journalistic targets. It's a famously untransparent institution. You are hopefully going to bring us inside of it. You and I were just talking recently about the sort of gold standard of books that does break through a bit. That's the classic Woodward book,
The Brethren.
Exactly. Has anyone ever matched that in terms of the ability to get inside this court?
It's pretty much a one-off. Nobody's ever really done it like they did it. There are a number of great books about the court, but getting inside, oh my God, it's really, really
but,
hard.
But you know, I have to
if
say,
anyone can do it, Jane Mayer can do it.
I don't know.
You have a consistent track record of saying, oh, this is the last hard book I do. And then you choose literally the hardest topic in the world. So we all are looking forward to that. So I don't know
Thank
why you're wasting time here with us. You should be home and writing. I think we have one last book we wanted to talk about, all of us. There are some books that endure, that have been around for a while, and yet somehow seem as present today as they were when they came out. One of those books is What It Takes by Richard Ben Cramer, which, after all, you know, is invoked in political writing constantly simply because it is so rare what it does. It gets in the mind of people who are possessed with this particularly strange idea, which is, I should be the president of the United States. Susan, is this a book that made an imprint on you when you were getting going in this business?
Absolutely. You know, there are a lot of classic books that people recommend or that you see written about. And if you go back and read them, they actually don't hold up very well. Or, you know, they're more interesting to read as period pieces or documents of a certain era. I would say that's not the case of What It Takes, which really certainly it's rooted in a certain it's the story of the different presidential candidates in the 1980s who come. So that's the very first and, you know, before Evan, the really best take on Joe Biden as a politician and as a candidate in 1988 is the first time that he ran for president. It famously imploded on him in ways that clearly shaped him to this day as a character. But it's not really a story about 1988, is my point. It's really a story about American politics, and I think it resonates for me today. I would recommend to anybody who hasn't read it to read it. It is the gold standard.
I mean, it's really even more than politics. I think it has to do with it's a psychological study of the strange chemistry of vulnerability and aspiration and strength and weakness, all of this stuff, which is always contending in the minds of these people. I find myself picking up What It Takes more often than almost anything else on the shelf.
What kind of access do you think he had?
Amazing access. I mean, he was able to get to people and just melt into the background, and they would talk themselves into this vibrant portrait. And so you got people like Bob Dole, who I think, you know, from the outside, Americans looked at somebody like Bob Dole and thought, okay, who is this guy? He looks kind of stern, wearing a suit. And when, you know, when you've got Richard Ben Cramer bringing him to life as a wounded soldier in World War II lying in a ditch, and that is not a treacly sentimental portrait. It is, in fact, a portrait of the making of a mind and how somebody becomes who they are.
Well, and this is this phenomenon that all of us are grappling with, which is that it's actually very hard to write in a nuanced, sophisticated, but also fully informed way, to Jane's point about access. And how do you have enough connection with these figures? One, I think, challenge for future generations is that White House's that I've seen over the last few decades in Washington have become progressively less accessible to journalists on a regular basis. And it's the paradox, the information paradox of our time, right, is that there's more and more stuff. We're being barraged with more media than ever before, but less and less really sort of high quality writing, thinking, and engagement with the subjects at the center of it.
You know, though, I was just thinking, there's one example, though, that kind of contradicts this, which is During the Reagan presidency, Edmund Morris, who had done a wonderful biography of Teddy Roosevelt, was invited into the Oval Office and into Reagan's life to chronicle Reagan. It was an authorized biography, and he spent years and years and years struggling with it and finally admitted that he couldn't crack Reagan. Reagan was such an opaque personality that even with the access, he felt there was kind of no there. And so, you know, I mean, it's always a combination of access plus being able to understand the person somehow through all the other reporting you do. And in that case, it never added up.
Well, and Jane, to your excellent point about that book, his preferred solution was, unfortunately for him, to actually fictionalize parts of his nonfiction account.
And a good idea.
As much as I started out by saying, you know, the virtues of fiction to help us understand how power works, definitely marrying the two is not the right course of action.
All right. There's the news you can use for the writer out there who's thinking about how to solve a problem in their outline. That's been a treat to chat with you guys about books. We are all readers and writers, and we'll all continue to be reading. Thank you, Jane, and thank you, Susan.
Well, thank you. This was fantastic. I hope that our listeners will send us their ideas for what they're reading in this very, very long election year of 2024.
This was really great. Thanks, guys. So much fun.
This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. I'm Evan Osnos. This episode was produced by Stephanie Karayuki and Dan Richards, with editing by Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you very much for listening.